I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. And by the way, it's National Punctuation Day, so let me insert an ellipsis here. Okay. Our country's military is at an especially turbulent moment. The withdrawal in Iraq has begun. The bill to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell remains stalled in the Senate. And in January of 2012, women will be allowed for the first time to serve on submarines. Well, in the middle of all this comes Christopher Brownfield's new book, My Nuclear Family, love that title, Coming of Age in America's 21st Century Military. It takes him from his post as an officer aboard a nuclear submarine to duty in Iraq with a detour at a Soho gallery along the way. I want to hear more about that. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Christopher to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well, and you?
I'm doing well. I have to say, because all politicians always say this, I honor your service. We have always heard that in the 2008 campaign, so I have to say that right from the beginning.
Well, I appreciate that, but please don't ask us to do this sort of thing again.
I know. We'll get into more of that in a minute. Let's hear a little bit about your background. What got you interested in military service to begin with?
Well, I think it was I watched a little bit too much Star Trek when I was a kid. And
really?
I thought that we could go out and save the world from some nuclear submarine and explore strange new places. And
did you really – was that really sort of your inspiration? Did you see it as – you know, because when I'm watching – you know, I watch too much sports, of course, and all of the advertising for all the branches of the military sort of make it look like sci-fi or video games or and you're of the age where you would have seen all that stuff. Were you influenced by that or?
Well, I mean, a lot of the advertisement for military recruiting has to do with fighting dragons and other sorts of fantastic things. Be an army of one,
right?
They make it sound like a video game, like you said. But when I was watching things like Star Trek as a kid, it's a show that touts diplomacy. It's a show that makes it possible for a military solution to big universal problems. And I thought that sounded appealing. I joined the force with high expectations of becoming not just an officer, but a gentleman, a diplomat of sorts, and found that it was quite different, actually, when I really got out to the fleet.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Michigan, but I joined the Navy at 17 and went to the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
Mm-hmm. And what was that experience like? What was your training like?
Oh, boy. That's going back a long way. The Naval Academy was a pretty rigid education, but surprisingly, I was able to be somewhat of a nonconformist by studying English literature at the Naval Academy. So I have a BS degree in English, which is very strange. But after I finished the academy, graduated in 2001, shook hands with President Bush, and went into the nuclear submarine force, I started studying nuclear engineering a lot more intensely and then finally made it out to the submarine fleet. So I was pursuing sort of a liberal education, trying to ask the big questions about the human condition, and I ended up kind of getting stuck in engineering.
Interesting. Well, now what of course, the human condition takes on a different meaning when you're underwater in a tiny
absolutely.
Little, although they are pretty big. They're not how many people are in, for example, the submarine that you served on for most of your
roughly
your time?
140 people 140 go on these people. Submarines, and it's just if you could try to imagine moving into your closet for 6 months, closing all the windows in your home just so it's nice and dark and only lit by fluorescent lights, and that's kind of what it's like. It is a claustrophobic kind of space. They try to lure people in by saying, well, they get better food on submarines. That's a total lie.
It's not true.
No, I mean, think about it. You go underwater, and after the first week, there are no fresh food, fruits or vegetables that can remain. Everything's got to be frozen or canned, and that's just awful.
Well, it's like being on a cruise ship, kind of. I mean, that's the same problem.
Well,
it's like
a cruise ship pulls into port. They get new vegetables every few days. So,
well,
you go swimming.
I did a crossing one time on the Queen Mary, so you're just going across. I just wanted you to know that I've also served on a vessel. I just wanted to make that very clear, just to level the playing field for a minute.
What sort of vessel was yours?
No, it was just a big Cunard.
Not going to go there.
Ocean liner. Okay. Now, so you wanted to be an officer and a gentleman
yes.
and a diplomat. Is the behavior in a submarine very gentlemanly? Is it?
Oh God, no! It's
Is it a zoo? What is it
it's
like?
It's a locker
there?
Room mentality, to put it politely. I mean,
and
it,
women are about to serve down.
And hopefully that'll bring a little bit of civility to that part of the service, because before, when it was all men, they called it all balls. It was just a locker room mentality. Whenever the captain wasn't looking, of course, people would stiffen up and try to look proper when the captain came by. But you know, it's just it gets to be a little bit raunchy. 140 guys together on a steel tube. Now, I'm not saying that 140 guys go down and 70 couples come up. That doesn't happen very often. It's relatively straight and innocent in terms of you know, how people behave, but. It's not what you see in the movies where the sailor snaps to attention and salutes.
Right. It's a little bit more more out of control than that. So how long did you serve in the submarine? How long were you down there total?
Well, I spent about 3 years on the Hartford, and when we would go out to sea, we would spend maybe a month underwater. The longest stretch I ever did was 54 days underwater at one time, which was pretty awful.
And in those 3 years, what were your missions like? What were you trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, that's the tricky thing about the submarine force right now, is that 9/11 happened, and we kind of were shaken awake with the realization that the Cold War is definitely over at this point. Mm-hmm. And these submarines were built to fight the Cold War. Mm-hmm. They cost billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, for all the infrastructure and the training and technology. And we came to the realization that we didn't have a very clear mission anymore. So there was this kind of flailing to justify our existence. And the Admiralty basically started inventing new missions for us to do. They put Tomahawk cruise missiles on a sub so that we could do strike warfare. But putting a Tomahawk on a submarine is about the most expensive way possible to launch a missile somewhere. You could do
missile.
It on a destroyer at a tenth of the cost of putting on a $1 billion fast attack submarine. So, you know, The mission of the fast attack submarine was pretty much gone, and they had other things that they did. They stamp it all top secret so that nobody, not even really Congress, has an idea of what's going on. There are very few congressmen who have security clearances, by the way, and even a smaller number who have access to the top secret information that most of the submarine operations fall under. But I mean, I have to be honest, after reading a lot of documents about what these things did, and I'm probably going to get myself into trouble for saying this, most of it was incredibly boring. I never saw anything that was really important in any of these secret documents or top secret documents that I read. And I honestly think that the big problem with the submarine force right now is that they haven't recognized that they're pretty much irrelevant to the wars that we're facing today, and a lot of the wars that we might be facing in the future. And it's very difficult for a massive government institution like that to say, I just don't think we're that important anymore. Maybe we should downsize.
So you think this is a case of the classic military-industrial complex perpetuating itself?
Yes.
Sort of regardless of its utility?
Yes, and I'd like to add, I'm glad you brought up that term, the military-industrial complex. President Carter just spoke about this in his diary that was published a couple of days ago, where he was quoting Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy. And Rickover said to Carter, who was also a submarine officer, he said in 1978, I think, that at the time, the military-industrial complex was 10 times more of a threat to the United States than it was during the Eisenhower administration, when President Eisenhower first made that warning to the American people upon leaving office. So that's coming from the father of the nuclear navy in 1970s. And I would say that right now it's even worse than it was at that point, because here we're faced with two different wars in this nebulous global war on terror, and this enormous Cold War platform costing hundreds of billions of dollars, and we have no idea what to do with it. And the congressmen who are getting these massive defense projects coming into their districts don't even have the security clearance to ask, what is this money doing? There are four or five people in Congress who actually know what these things, or they have access. I don't even know if they understand what the submarines are doing. But there are only four or five congressmen who have access to this top secret information, and there's so many mountains and mountains of boring top secret documents that I just don't think that anybody's gone through it and really questioned, are these things adding the value that we need them to add? Is there a better way that we could spend $250 billion?
I'm talking to Christopher Brownfield about his book, My Nuclear Family, A Coming of Age in America's 21st Century Military. This is Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. You know, what's interesting, Chris, is that the people who often question the value of this, you know, multi-billion dollar superstructure are people who served in the military themselves. Oftentimes the civilian leadership will sign off on new programs or new expenditures in the military for a variety of reasons, for fear of seeming soft on defense or there's pork and letting down. You know, it's a big jobs issue, obviously, if you can build things and all of that. But you've actually, you know, been down there. You went from serving in the submarine. You voluntarily signed up to serve in the Green Zone in Iraq, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And what was your thinking there? Were you still very much idealistic about the mission there? Or?
I was very idealistic, and you know, this was 2006. I had already resigned my commission, and I was just waiting for the Navy to process my resignation. I'd been accepted to graduate school at Yale, so I had one foot in the door at the Ivory Tower.
And what were you going to study?
I was going to study business, and what I'd hoped was to get involved with some sort of international development, which I think is really important for dealing with problems of extremism. If you want to deal with extremism, then create opportunities for people, try to help people to have the sorts of liberties that we enjoy, but not doing it with, you know, an occupational force, doing it through engagement and breaking down barriers. So in 2006, I had one foot in the door at Yale, and the generals in the Army were sort of doing an inter-service draft, picking people from the Navy and the Air Force to fill positions in the headquarters. And I think they wanted to wait until after the midterm elections in 2006 to announce that they just didn't have enough people to fight the wars. And sure enough, about 3 days after the midterm elections, the generals came on television and said, well, we're a little bit shorthanded. And at that point, I'd already volunteered, and I was going to Iraq to fill a position in the headquarters. My reason for doing it was that I felt like I just spent 4 years studying about how to drive nuclear submarines and driving these submarines on missions around the world, and I felt like we just hadn't done anything that was really valuable in helping to end this global war on terror or solving any of the big problems that we faced. And I thought, you know, I signed up for the Navy with intentions of serving my country. I want to do something good. So I decided to go to Iraq to try to help clean up after some of the mess that was made there in the irresponsible part of the occupation in 2003.
Right. And what were your specific duties in Iraq?
Well, just by complete chance, I ended up in the directorate where we were responsible for oil and electricity. And basically, our directorate was the only unit that reported directly to the commanding general every day on the oil and electricity situation throughout Iraq. And my official job title was a liaison officer, and that meant that I worked between the U.S. government, the Iraqi government. We talked to cabinet ministers regularly, and we also worked with the State Department to try to coordinate policies. So it was this kind of high-minded thing where we would go and try to bring things like energy independence to Iraq. We would try to
isn't that kind of an ironic goal, given they're sitting on this incredible oil reserve? Was the industry there, the oil industry, so totally degraded at that point? Or I know there
was pretty dilapidated.
I know there were tremendous oil shortages all over the place.
Well, we destroyed an enormous amount of the oil and electrical infrastructure in the first Gulf War, and they never really recovered from that because the sanctions that we put in place prevented them from developing the infrastructure to its full potential. So they were still trying to recover from that war when we got there in 2003. You know, about energy independence, yes, it was naive, but, you know, I was a guy who just came from a nuclear submarine, which is a Cold War machine that could sustain its environment and its mission without oil pretty much indefinitely. These things can go underwater. They make their own oxygen. They scrub their own CO2 from the atmosphere. I learned a lot about energy independence from this relic of the Cold War, which is really kind of weird. And then that kind of made me think that it was possible to help lead Iraq toward energy independence, that we could take this country with almost limitless oil supplies and find a way to get themselves to become independent. But, you know, it was really a naive pursuit. By the time I left in 2007, I realized that what we had really done with trying to make Iraq independent was we had cut it off from all of its neighbors. Iraq has six contiguous neighbors, and it wasn't really cooperating with any of them on solving the big picture energy problems that it faced. Now, the problem with that, obviously, is that they should have been cooperating more. They should have been trying to tear down the political barriers and to cooperate with Turkey and Iran and Syria instead of demonizing these countries. To give you an example, when we were there, we helped to orchestrate the first major deal where the government of Iraq purchased diesel fuel from Kuwait. Now, Kuwait and Iraq didn't have a very cozy relationship after Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. So this was a big political step, but we finally got Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to go to Kuwait and buy diesel fuel. And there was this hilarious moment where the prime minister was taken aback at how expensive it was to buy gas from its neighbor. I mean, it's the first time in his life that the prime minister of a petroleum state had ever bought gas. It was just hilariously naive.
Well, that's a learning experience,
yeah, yeah.
I think, for everybody. So this story is a story of disillusionment. I mean, that's basically right. The arc of the story, because you are a young idealistic guy, and your encounters with the military left you feeling a different way. One of your heroes at the beginning of the story was John McCain.
Yes.
And by the time I got to chapter 16, which is called McCainery Chicanery, I got the impression that you had turned a little bit on him. What turned you against him, and what are your feelings about him?
Well, if there's anyone who turned, I think it was Senator McCain when he was trying to compromise mm-hmm. to gain enough political clout from the far right in order to mount a presidential bid in 2008. I grew up in the Naval Academy, so we idolized people like John McCain and Oliver North. And it was only when I saw some of the practices that were put in place for how we dealt with detainees, for example. They were locking people up without any sort of legal process. An attorney who I worked with, who was also a state congressman in New York, said that it's not due process, but it's the process we do. They were just locking people up indefinitely, even if they had no evidence of what they had done. But it got worse than that. I ended up talking to people like Senator Lindsey Graham in Baghdad, who was serving. He was doing 2 weeks of his reserve time by serving in Baghdad. So he wasn't just there for a dog and pony show. He was really spending his time wearing camouflage, carrying a weapon like everyone else. And Graham said to me at a private dinner that we had to get some convictions of Iraqi terrorists to take the pressure off the Bush administration for keeping Guantanamo Bay open. Hmm. In other words, he wanted show trials to take pressure off of President Bush so that they could justify keeping these people in detention indefinitely without due process.
Well, Chris, you do a great job getting into all this and so much more in your book. I want to thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Christopher Brownfield, the author of My Nuclear Family, A Coming of Age in America's 21st Century Military. It's published by Knopf. Thanks for joining me. This is Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, WNYC and WNYC.org.